including in Worcester, Rhode Island, etc. And then there was Boston, of course. And then there was the protests that were really big and very quickly organized right after Trump got elected. So that was November. It's only towards the end of January, and you've had three kind of waves of protest, including student walkouts, including protests in cities that don't usually have protests. I don't know if you noticed that, if you got any of those Facebook posts from I don't mean to make fun of any place, but let's say City X from Nebraska had an anti-Trump protest or a Women's Day march. I love that stuff. That is so great. It's so powerful and so brave of people in places where there isn't a mass movement or organizational strength against Trump. I've tried to organize, and I think hopefully somewhat successfully, because it's still happening, I'll say that. That's the criteria, I guess. In places that don't usually, where the left has a small presence, and Socialist Alternative is able to organize in places like that. It's difficult, but we're able to organize. You know, it's interesting, just as a digression, one of the things about organizing for socialism and for anything else to the left in the United States is the absence of a political party for working people to show an example that of class independence from big business and the corporations, to show victories of working class people in a very clear light. That, for example, the Democrats will say, we won the victory, of Roe versus Wade or something, ignoring the mass movement that won the victory. So there's a lot of Democratic Party usurpation, is that a word, of radical, even in the United States, radical left initiatives that and movements that were not under the control of the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party will take credit for them. Like $15 minimum wage in Seattle, right? That was definitely started and led by Socialist Alternative. Others got involved heavily. Very important union involvement, very important community involvement. I'm not trying to give all the credit to Socialist Alternative. I'm just saying that the Democratic Party was not a big part of that movement. In fact, they opposed it at the top. They opposed it, right? They opposed it. Then after it's in, they try to take credit for it. Happens all the time in U.S. politics, right? But the reality on the ground is different. But not having a workers' party to show that reality, and I don't care what it's called, Socialist Party, Communist Party, whatever, without Labor Party, whatever, without having that to show that reality, boy, you've really got one hand tied behind your back when you're out there organizing, because people will think you're talking about the Democratic Party sometimes, or they'll fall back on their own in the Democratic Party and nothing changes. The Democratic Party is not going to change anything. It's going to bring things backwards as it already has under the Obama administration, under the Clinton administration, et cetera. But the other problem is there's sort of like these structural, and they can be overcome. These are logistical problems that can be overcome, but you'd be surprised. The sort of dominance of the fossil fuel industry and the automobile industry in this country has created vast swaths of the United States where people basically never get together. They're always in their cars. Then they go somewhere and they stop. They go from that place and their cars into that place. There's no pedestrian area. There's no place where people mingle. There's no even subway stops where you can guarantee a crowd going in and out of the subways. Many cities don't have subways, right? Then you say, well, what about train stations, bus stations? Yeah, to a certain extent, but most people are in their cars, and the bus stations tend to be small. Train stations tend to be small, not utilized enough. And, of course, there are exceptions, and where there are, especially in northeastern big cities, it's much easier in some ways. Not, this doesn't solve all your problems, but it's a lot easier to organize. You can actually find people on the street who you can set up an information table and talk to them and stuff and get, because, you can't go through the corporate media. They won't let you on the air. And you can't get into schools for the most part because they're controlled by the big corporations. The churches controlled by the big corporations ideologically and sometimes in terms of laws written in their favor and all that. So you go through every institution in American society. Unions, well, sometimes you can have an influence in unions, but the traditions of mass union meetings, traditions of unions fighting, the traditions of democracy within unions, all severely, severely weakened. So then you have these gatekeepers at the head of unions. Sometimes they think they're progressive too by keeping their union walled off from the left and all those ideas that might not fit their preconceived notions of how to bring unions forward. Meanwhile, their members are voting for Trump, you know, or some of them or whatever. But anyway, union education, union democracy, union militancy, all on the wane, all going downhill for the most part, and hit the bottom of the hill in a lot of cases. And so you're basically, you're organizing the United States from a socialist perspective. You're organizing from the ground up, very grassroots organizing. And you build organization, your own organization, and get in, alliances with other organizations and the ones that aren't NGO controlled and so on. I'm talking about, and it's tough raising the money. No rich liberals giving you money, no corporations giving you money. It is really hard. And that, on top of it all, that insult to injury, people just aren't on the street, you know, not on a normal basis. And so in some cities, there have been anti-Trump rallies, there have been women's marches and so on, where those logistical barriers, which are significant, are just overcome. Like, all of a sudden, this area becomes a pedestrian area, you know? Like, where I've been helping organize in Worcester, we're getting this, we're getting the city used to the fact that this plaza before, in front of City Hall, is a plaza for protests, you know? It's not just an empty space like so much of American architecture where the wind blows through and plastic bags blow through. You know, this is actually a place where people are turning into a space for protest and so on. And if I'm echoing the Occupy movement a little bit with that, so be it. That's true. Occupy had a lot of problems, some deadly to its own self. but trying to conquer public space, trying to create public space was a good thing, was a good part of that. So don't forget about that rally today. Again, and if you're in the Boston area, and it's probably happening in other cities as well, all I have is the Boston info right now. Today, 1 to 3 p.m., Copley Square in Boston, fight Trump's executive actions banning entry into U.S. from 7 Muslim nations. Fight the racism of the Trump administration. Fight this, like, Christianity thing. I mean, okay, I'm an atheist, but part of what I believe in as a, just, you know, what I believed in before I became a socialist, but it was reinforced as a revolutionary socialist, people do have a right to religion, also a right from religion, to be not be part of religion. And within the socialist movement, again, back to that idea of workers' unity we talked about before, we want to have maximum unity despite religious differences, gender differences, racial differences, etc. Ethnic differences. We need maximum unity as much as we can get in the workers' movement, right? And that includes unions, political parties to the left, left-wing revolutionary organizations, etc. We need maximum workers' unity. And again, that's not being talked about enough now, obviously. Instead, differences are accentuated. And sometimes that discussion is very important, but, there's also a point where that discussion has to be, despite this and that, we need to be together. And you have a right to speak. You all have a right. Everyone has a right to speak. Everyone has a right to organize. Everyone has a right to join an organization if it doesn't, even doesn't fit their demographic, you know. And I'm not talking about class demographic. I'm talking about, you know, all the other things that are thrown into divide and conquer working people, racial constructs, or real racism, and policies that promote that. But here we have religion being used by the right-wing populist regime of Trump, posit Christianity over all other religions, put forward Christianity over all other religions. This is ridiculous, you know? This is horrible. There should be moral outrage against it, and there is. You'll see the Christian right emboldened by this to a certain extent to push their agendas, especially like in southern states and so on. But the way leftists should handle this is say, you have a right, come into our organization, you have a right to your religious beliefs, but this organization is not a religious organization. We're not here to promote religious beliefs, but you have a right to your personal religious beliefs. No problem. We believe in that. We'll fight for that. That's how we should go forward. If you're an atheist, don't sit it out. Like, you know, and I'm not, I'm an atheist. I'm not sitting it out. You have to fight for people's right to have a religious belief and to have not to have that and have that and not to have that used against them, to put it confusedly. it's not confusing. If someone decides to become a Muslim, they should not have that right challenged, especially by the government of the United States, with all its killing of Muslims overseas, not by the corporations, not, you know, the only challenge I would say that's allowable to religion, and many religions unfortunately would reject this, is a critical philosophical challenge when the time comes for that sort of discussion or whatever. But in terms of politics, in terms of socialist politics, in terms of fighting Trump, we need maximum unity among working people, among the working class. That means that we have to say, yes, you have a right to your religion. You have a right not to be religious. Together, we're going to fight for those rights. That may seem like ABC, but boy, you can see people forgetting it here and there. We're going to take a quick break. Before we do that, we'll just identify. This is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. And you're listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Free Form Radio, also known as Tufts Commercial Free Radio. I like that one. I think I made that one up, Commercial Free Radio, but we are commercial free, and I really hate commercials. So we're Tufts Free Form Radio, Commercial Free Radio, Community-Based Radio, and you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working-class, democratic socialist perspective, part of that community base here, at Tufts Educational Radio. We have a lot of different names. I like Tufts Educational Radio a lot, too. And when we come back, we'll be talking a little more about Trump and then getting into some more deeper problems. And thanks for listening and stay tuned. Where did our... Oh, wait a minute. We don't have the... we don't have what we need up here right now to move to what I wanted to move to. So we're going to keep going. We'll just keep going. Actually, what I want to... I'm missing something I need. Oh, well, I'm sorry about that. So there's a good article in Counterpunch that I wanted to recommend by Yoav Litvin. And that is Trump's America, Land of Dystopia and Resistance. And that came January 27th, 2017 on counterpunch.org. And we've talked about Counterpunch on the air before. It's a good website. And actually print newsletter, although you have to pay for the print newsletter and harsh times and all that. I'm not paying for that currently, not getting it currently. And one point he makes in here that I think is really important is that the memory of Barack Obama, which he correctly calls neoliberal Democrat Barack Obama, is fading so quickly. And that sounds like, well, what does that have to do with Trump? Everything to do with Trump. Remember when Clinton ran during the campaign, it was in defense, and she said this openly and directly, it was in defense of the status quo and wanting to carry through Obama administration policies. And that is something that we have to be aware of. And it's not good to forget what Obama did. But he makes another point here that's interesting. In what may be the... Let me just get the quote straight here. In what may be the defining moment of his presidency, Obama assured a smooth transition of power to the American oligarch, Trump, as she says, Drumpf, and his merry band of misogynists, religious zealots, and white supremacists. Now, what does that mean? That's a point that... leads to some deeper points here. If the Democratic Party was a true opposition party, if it truly represented a different social class or classes than the upper class and the upper middle class, the capitalist class and the upper middle class, if it truly represented the working class, really had an alternative to the system, then the election would not be the end of the story. A true opposition party would fight. A true opposition party would say we have an alternative system of government in mind, not just mimicking and following the traditions laid down by slave owners and the rich in the past. And here's what we mean by that. For example, some countries that takes the form of, let's call a constituent assembly. Let's start from almost scratch or whatever. Call a constituent assembly. All the constituencies in society should get together, figure out a new form of government that more represents people than this one certainly has not, that hasn't done a good job representing people. And the people that would be part of an opposition party, and I'm not talking about like a petulant opposition, like, we didn't really lose the election, and so we just want the same power. But an opposition party, again, remember the criteria, that really represents a different social class, that really has an alternative that really is out for fundamental change and not just taking the same governmental structures and using them for their wielding their own power. All that doesn't exist in the United States, obviously. And in many countries, even parties that started out revolutionary social democratic parties and so on, they no longer have any sort of agenda like that in mind. But it's important to understand here in the United States how the transition of the Obama administration into if you want to use that word, normalizing Trump or letting it be known that this is okay, should be a big lesson for people that are making that jump from liberalism to real politics, to real social change from the left. Liberalism is not leftism. Liberalism is basically defense of the capitalist system and supporting capitalist political parties. In the context of the United States, and this is deliberate, the corporate media will call liberals left-wing. They'll create a false paradigm of left, meaning liberals, right, meaning conservatives. Often liberals will be Democrats, conservatives, Republicans. I've even seen that paradigm used within narrower terms to describe something happening within the Democratic Party or within the Republican Party. So the idea of what really left means, being anti-capitalist and not supporting pro-capitalist political parties, is pretty much not out there within the United States that much in a big way, and it needs to be. And I think one of the lessons in that is that ask yourself why the Democratic Party, and if people were asking themselves this in 2000 too, why the Democratic Party allows the Republican Party to take power when they did not get the majority of votes in the country. But more to the point, or a deeper point, why do they not have any sort of alternative? Why do they try so hard to normalize Trump, for example, in this election? And again, even the most so-called progressive or so-called left of the Democrats, which I really object to the term again, but whatever, Warren and Sanders, why are they voting for some of, like Warren voted for Carson for the housing position on Trump's cabinet. Why do they both make public statements saying they support the president, but, you know, there should be no support the president type thing. And you know, here in Social Alternative, Trump is not our president. We're not supporting Trump. And that drives a lot of the conservatives crazy. Oh, they get onto Facebook for that. They're like, oh my goodness, it's your president, blah, blah. No. I'm a revolutionary socialist, a democratic socialist as well. Democratic doesn't mean Democratic Party. It means democratic in terms of democratic institutions, society. And the United States has a long way to go to have real democracy. A long way to go. So I don't want to just see this government structure as it is maintained indefinitely until it collapses through its contradictions and its and the things and from the problems that capitalism engenders through, like, you know, basically deadly wars and climate change and pollution and all that. I want to see people survive, you know, and that will take a different form of government, and it'll have to be an international government as well. You know, part of the, you know, normalizing of the Trump administration is to then, and this is something that maybe, I don't know, maybe it's a little subtle or whatever, I don't know, but it's something I found when a lot of people that, even those that consider themselves leftist, incorrectly, but that's what they consider themselves, during the election when they argued for Clinton, they would argue from a position defending the basics of the system. They weren't aware of it. All of a sudden, they're making arguments about, oh, well, Clinton has experience. But by saying that, you're saying experience as part of the ruling class, as part of the oligarchy, as part of the imperialist tool, you know, box of repression and war around the world. Why would that be an argument? If you're a leftist, why is that an argument for you? You know, or they would say things about, you know, they'd say nationalist stuff. You know, buying into myths about American politics and so-called democracy and so on, and consciously or unconsciously defending the system that, at another time, they would say, oh yeah, this system is genocide against Native Americans, slavery, racism, Jim Crow racism, et cetera, indentured servants, women don't get the vote until way late. You know, they would come up with these criticisms that should equal systemic change, should equal a deeper criticism of the economic system and the government than it has, you know, than just arguing for Hillary. And that's 'cause that's not arguing for systemic change. Anyway, the other thing is that in this article that I think is worth reading again, let's go back to what we're talking about here. This is an article by, or what triggered some of that. Trump's America, Land of Dystopia and Resistance by Yaov Litvin, January 27th, 2017, Counterpunch. So he says, well, you know, here's what Obama has done to help, you know, ease the transition, which shouldn't be eased at all. Getting into Trump, some things that have happened so far. And here he goes. Here's another part I wanted to point out. He goes, quote, but a common enemy is not sufficient. In order for a resistance to succeed, it must define clear fundamental principles, set a series of goals, and lay out a realistic strategy to accomplish them. Those groups that cannot rally behind a common productive agenda and are only defined by what they are against must be excluded. So he's saying it's not good enough to just be against Trump. And I would agree with that, although I'm not sure I'd agree with the exclusion part. I mean, there could be a united front with groups that are clearly not about fundamental change, but are fighting on a single issue or a bunch of issues that can be agreed upon in a moment. What I mean by united front is a socialist term for fighting with socialist or non-socialist groups around a common goal, usually a single issue or, again, a bunch of issues or maybe even a candidate. But doing so in a way that doesn't hide the identity or the program of the socialist groups involved or socialist parties involved or any of the groups involved, really. And that leadership of the movement isn't de facto lowest common denominator, like, say, the democratic liberal person or grouping involved. It could be the socialists, the radicals, you know, revolutionary socialists could be the leaders if they're elected into that. Even in just one campaign or whatever. But it's important, you know, that point that he's making, that you have to have more than just being against Trump. And I really believe that it's going to be tough for even those that are not left wing and don't even want to be left wing. They're going to find it tough to just be constantly tearing down Trump without any sort of alternative for working people in general. And for the groups that Trump's going after as well. Because, you know, one anecdotal thing, I saw that during the Reagan administration a lot. There was just a lot of, people got really good at tearing down Reagan, really good at, you know, I remember whole entire books being published with ridiculous quotes from Reagan and his cabinet appointees, how just completely stupid and evil they were, you know. But it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough because, you know, you have to have a way forward. And the Democrats clearly didn't. Remember, Reagan came in. Now, okay, in the revisionist history that you probably will read, where Reagan's a good guy and Carter's a good guy, the reality on the ground was the 1974-75, there was a deep recession. And this really, worldwide, and this really screwed with people, really messed them up bad. And coming out of the recession, there was an explosion of inflation in this country. When Ford was in power for a short time, and then when Carter was in power. And to deal with inflation, they decided to deflate the economy in ways that would hurt workers and that would promote the corporate agenda. And they also wanted to go after unions more. There was a concerted effort beginning during the Nixon administration that didn't take hold because of the mass movement basically preventing it. To do a renewed attack on unions, to test the waters, say, how far can we get attacking unions? And unfortunately, they can get very, very far because the leadership of the unions had turned mostly conservative, pro-business, and so on. A unionship can't be pro-business and keep a union alive. And there would be some building trades union leaders that would disagree with me vehemently on that, but I would say your days are numbered, building trade unionists. And some of them would say, we don't know what you're talking about, and that's because some of them are also, you know, see their way out of the labor movement by becoming contractors or whatever. But those that would not be able to do that I might be able to get them to agree ultimately. Anyway, we'll see. The point is here that the you have a certain level of a certain lack of alternative against the system, or to go rise beyond just attacking the sort of spearhead of the capitalist class, which Trump represents. That now the thing with Trump is he's a straight out capitalist. He's just not a career politician like Nixon or even a spokesperson like Reagan that is a tool of the capitalist class, and that is really what they were. Trump is partially that, but Trump sort of trumps them, no pun intended, or pun intended, by being an outright capitalist. And does that fundamentally change the situation? No, because you can't say because Nixon was a career politician that psychologically he wasn't totally pro-big business. He was totally pro-big business. Come on. So anyway, or that Reagan was any better because he wasn't a capitalist himself or not till late in life or something like that. I mean, a real capitalist. No, it doesn't really matter that much. Anyway, so then this guy, again, quoting from this article that I think is worth reading by, it's not that long an article, I'm just, riffing off it. Yov Litvin, January 27th, Counterpunch. He, sets up the argument, both parties are guided by the destructive principles of capitalism and imperialism. Neither party promotes social welfare for regular Americans. Neither party provides pragmatic solutions for the crises of the 21st century. This is very, very true. I like how he put that very succinctly. The American political system itself, and thus both corporate parties, are directly responsible for the ascension of Trump and his dangerous agenda. In fact, a recent report by the Economist Intelligence Unit downgraded the U.S. from a, quote, full democracy, end quote, to a flawed democracy, end quote, which is kind of funny because the Economist is, of course, extremely pro-capitalist. And that actually made, once the Economist said that, that made the rounds in some of the corporate media and alternative media. But anyway, then he goes, no more Clintons, Schumers, or Pelosi's. These corporate sellouts, warmongers, and sheepdogs have too long served to anesthetize people into passivity, cynicism, and selfishness while colluding with their benefactors to rob public resources. Led by a coalition of groups that place people and planet before profit, a resistance must work toward Donald Trump's ouster as a first step toward revolutionizing American politics with the ultimate goal of empowering a truly democratic and radical alternative to the duopoly. The effects of such a revolution will reverberate around the world and may be the last hope we have for peace and prosperity as a species. And I agree with that. I would just be more concrete. I mean, it has to take the form, in my opinion, of a mass movement for a workers' party. And then out of that, eventually, truly revolutionary change along lines of democratic socialism. Now, there's... As I mentioned earlier in the show, Socialist Alternative is going to do a campaign for another member of Socialist Alternative to become a city councilor, this time in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And by another, I mean that we have a city councilor in who's been elected and reelected in Seattle, Shama Sawant. And there is, I'm just distracted by a little logistical thing here. Sorry, I'm back. It's fully in front of my mic. And we are, Ginger Jensen is running for, I believe, Ward 3 in Minneapolis and pushing for one of the main campaign planks or points for a $15 minimum wage, which has been opposed by both the Democrats and Republicans in Minnesota. But is very has polled very highly and is very popular among the people, no question there. And I'm just waiting for, there's going to be one of these days coming up soon where we're going to have to switch gears and go beyond 15. And by the way, Socialist Alternative and others are not saying that a $15 minimum wage is a panacea or actually even a living wage. A $15 minimum wage is just a big step towards a living wage and a necessary, important one. I remember when we first started talking about 15 a few years ago, and maybe 4 years ago, let's say 3 to 4 years ago, even after we were starting to win on it, there would be people that would argue with you that it wasn't a really good a demand, you know? And the, you know, that you know, I'm talking about working people would actually argue with, you know, it's too much, you know, and they would give the cliched arguments that they're taught to give by the corporate media, by the educational system. You know, it would hurt businesses. They'd have to lay people off. Well, all that's been proven wrong empirically by places that have raised the minimum wage, not just $15 minimum wage, but even before that. There's a whole bunch of studies and political arguments that are backed up by studies and so on that you can read that disprove that, you know, because, you know, as we've said on the show before, but I'll go through it real quick right now. Say you're a business owner, big or small, and all of a sudden, the people say through a mass movement or through electing a socialist like Shama Sawant, the socialist alternative, we want a $15 minimum wage. We got the law. Boom, start paying the $15. Well, some businesses, by the way, are going to try to weasel out of it. They're going to, you know, not pay it. There's a lot of wage theft out there. There's a lot of sleazy business practices, even among the vaunted small businesses, of course. But what is, but it's going to hit a certain number of businesses that are going to feel they have to pay it. And hopefully there's some enforcement of it. And so they start paying it. And what is the choice of the business? The business can say, oh, this is cutting into my profits so much that I'm going to, this is what some, maybe a big business could do. Could is the operative word, but we'll hear more about that in a second. Say, well, that's hitting my profits so much that I'm going to go invest in something that's going to make a bigger return on my investment. But hold on a second. They can do that anytime. They can do that when the minimum wage is lower, when the minimum wage goes up a little bit. They can still do that. That's unfortunately the nature of capitalism. They can take their capital and invest it into whatever they want. And they don't care about people's needs. They just care about what's going to maximize their investment. So they're going to take that investment and they're going to run with it and do something that could be horrible, just financial speculation or military, creating the next generation of destructive nuclear weapons or something. We have no control as a society over where capital gets spent, where investment goes. And that's part of the, that's a big part of the horribleness of capitalism, is that the value that we generate through our work, I'm talking about working people, through our labor power, whether it's highly sophisticated, so-called highly trained scientists or whatever who haven't got enough money yet together to become capitalists, or whether it's somebody doing what's considered menial work. I don't believe that, but, you know, work that doesn't take much training or something, but that's still, you know, obviously necessary. It wouldn't exist. That work, whether it's the top, you know, the so-called professional work or work that's unskilled, all work needing to be done, those people that do that work, workers, do not control what they produce. They don't control the value they produce. They don't control the capital that comes out of the difference between their wages and the capital that comes out of you know, their wages, costs, and then the surplus value that comes out of the process, and the part of that surplus value going to profit, part of that profit, if the capitalists so choose, going to capital and investment in something. No control over that. In fact, that's another option, by the way. The capitalists can just close up shop anytime and say, hey, that's enough. I'm going to retire, or I'm going to go, you know, just spend money promoting a new religion or something. You know, there's no law that says the capitalist has to stay in the game, you know, in the investment game. And there are plenty of people with piles of money that aren't capitalists or investors. They're super rich, but they just don't bother to really you know, directly invest that money. Now, that's a little rare, because even someone sitting back on a trust fund, the trust fund's probably going to have investments and all that, but they're not going to be directly involved in that. They don't have to be. But more to the point, you've got people, you've got businesses that are going to pay the 15, and they're going to realize that it hasn't cut into their cost that much, that, or maybe at all, because, oh, the corporate media forgets to mention, a business and its market share may be growing. You know, maybe if it's a big business like CVS or Whole Foods or Walmart or something, they've cornered the market in a geographic area, and so people are going to just go there. They have to, kind of, to get certain things. And whether or not if Walmart's paying $15 an hour, which they're not probably anywhere right now, but if they're forced to in certain areas in the future, or another company is forced to, I know Whole Foods is probably forced to pay 15 in Seattle, then they might realize all of a sudden that despite that $15 minimum wage increase, their actual profits are going up. Their actual rate of profit even is going up because they've gained market share. Because for other reasons, they've gained more business. There's more demand for their products, you know? And it might just be, and this is an argument that a lot of people for $15 minimum wage will make, that it might just be because people have more money in their pockets through a higher minimum wage, they can then go spend it. Duh. And they do. And then there's increased profits. So what turned out was supposed to be only a losing proposition. You put in $15 and you're definitely going to lose that. The reality is that, no, you don't lose it. There's actually gains being made. Or, and God forbid this becomes knowledge to the vast majority of the people, because you're this capitalist businessman and you own, you're getting profits, guess what? Your profits always fluctuate based on a lot of variables, including costs, including labor costs. So you're actually used, if you're a business CEO or business owner, small business owner, whatever, if you're honest, you're used to the fact that your profits fluctuate based on a lot of variables. It could be the lack of demand because, I don't know, it snowed a lot that winter or something and people couldn't get out to shop, or you don't have an online presence, or it could be you just invested in new machinery and took a hit on that. And so for that quarter, you've paid more into machinery and your profit rate went down. There's so many variables. I won't waste time listing them, but I hope you can get the picture and you can think of others on your own. Costs go up. And then it turns out that many times in businesses, those costs, different costs go up and you're still making more profit, still have a higher aggregate and percentage profit. So 15 becomes doesn't enter in the equation in a lot of cases. Or when it does, it's not a crippling thing. Or here we go, it turns out it is an added cost, but because my profits are variable, sometimes not going up as much, sometimes even going down, I will just take that because I do not want to withdraw for whatever reason from that investment. I'm the big capitalist here, or the small capitalist. They say, okay, I'm taking a hit on my profits, but pretty soon I'm going to get more money. And this is before we've talked about raising prices, before we've talked about laying anybody off, which are apparently the only two things they can ever do. The reality is they could be adding workers under 15 and making much higher profits based on a whole variety of other factors, like higher demand for their product, like the fact that they've discovered some way to market it or to make it cheaper through the use of some sort of machine they didn't have before, or machinery, or workers have more money in their pockets, getting back to that one, and they're spending more, including on that place that has to now pay 15 or is supposed to be paying 15 to the workers. So the capitalist can take lower profits based on higher costs. And that word cost is tricky because that's what they say. A worker is a cost. Really, the worker is not a cost. The worker is creating value. You know, there'd be no business without the workers. That's the thing that's so funny about the way business people, I'm talking about the CEOs, the owners, the way they see businesses, and they say, oh, I created this business. You didn't create anything. Come on. Come on. You can't put one widget together yourself. It took workers to do that. You could take care of all your customers. Say it's a service business, right? Say it's a deli or something, or bigger. Say it's a grocery store. Yeah, okay, maybe one day you could run production with yourself, right? Today I'm going to run around and you know, bag the groceries, and you know, I've got automation, so maybe they can use the automated checkout or something. But I want to stock the shelves. I'm going to clean. I'm going to do everything. Of course, it's absurd. It's absurd. The reality of work under capitalism, it's one of the things that capitalism brought into being that is one of the contradictions of capitalism, is brought in socialized production, but private ownership. Complete contradiction. It takes a lot of working people to produce anything in this society, And yet working people are deliberately kept from controlling what they produce, whether it's a thing or a service. And they're kept from decisions like what's to be invested in and how things are to be made and all that sort of thing. There's no democracy in the economy, in other words. So when you talk about democracy in America, you're talking about a very narrow thing. Some political democracy dominated by big money, dominated by big business, big corporations, and only allowed in certain ways. So anyway, getting back to the point, is $50 minimum wage does not necessarily and usually does not impact workers in the way we're, impact business owners the way we're taught. However, here's the big caveat. I mean, all these arguments, which are, by the way, unassailable arguments. They're arguments that an honest capitalist economist would agree with. What's, you know, but they aren't that honest. Or they wouldn't be capitalist economists, right? So what's left out of the equation, though, and I did kind of touch on it, is that it is the decision of the capitalists what to do with their money. So if they get pissed off, right, that if they see 15 as a, you know, a victory for the workers, they could make more money somewhere else if they invest it in financial speculation, something like that, a lot more money, let's say. Yeah, they can take their ill-gotten gains, their money they're stealing from the workers, because all you know, profit is theft, basically. It's the unpaid wages of the working class. They can take that and run. A lot of them don't, because they're still making a lot of money, and that really, don't ever understand the greed of the capitalists, you know. So they don't actually cut and run as often as they threaten to. But yeah, they could, at the end of the day, one of them could say, oh, I'm really mad about this $50 minimum wage, and I'm taking everything, taking my capital and going somewhere else, you know. Well, socialists have an answer for that. It's called public ownership. If it's a significant business, then we should just say, oh, hey, you're moving. First of all, that money's really not yours. It's money the workers made for you. It's money people spent and gave to you for that good or whatever. So, nah, we want to keep this open, actually. We're taking this over. This is called public ownership, eminent domain, whatever name you put on it. We're taking it over for the public good. And so these people have jobs. We need this thing produced. Boom, see you later. You can go live in Bermuda with your money if you want. We don't care. It's, even though it's not really your money, what's really not yours is that thing that generates profit for you, because really what that is workers working to create a good or a service. Anyway, we're going to get more concrete, back to the concrete nature of this $15 minimum wage and other things that we can win under the Trump administration. Washington Post on January 26th had an interesting article, quote, Maryland Democrat wants to ban local governments from boosting minimum wage. Now, the Post writes this as if this never happened in any other state. Unfortunately, oh no, I'm sorry, they did mention it. Under the measure, which is similar to laws in place in Oklahoma, Alabama, South Carolina, Texas, and Missouri, all those wonderfully progressive states, local governments can only set base pay for their own employees. So this is a thing that the bosses have, using the state that they control, using the two political parties they control, they have in certain states created laws, and I believe it goes beyond those states, but I hope not. I think Minneapolis has this as well, but not Minneapolis, I'm sorry. They're trying to get it in Minneapolis, but I think it exists in other states. Anyway, yeah, the two corporate parties, including the Democrats, are trying to pass laws that make it impossible to get even local increases in the minimum wage, like the 15 Now movement's running into that. And let's see. Baltimore's considering a $15 minimum wage. That's what really got this Democrat all and other Democrats all into making it impossible for one city or county to increase the minimum wage. And that's just another example of what I'm talking about, from everything from you need an alternative, you're not going to find it in the Democrats, to the need for making gains under the Trump administration. Now, I mentioned Shama Sawant. Oh, by the way, I forgot one other thing from a really good article to read from Socialist Alternatives website. During the next 100 days, build resistance to Trump's agenda, published on January 26th by Brian Koulouris. And this is a good rundown of a lot of the stuff I've sort of come at, except for the most recent stuff over the last 72 hours last week, come at from different issues. All the issues are kind of put together here really in a really effective way, including issues directing, addressing U.S. imperialism and so on. issues on the Democratic Party. For example, and this is why I wanted to touch on this, quote, the Democrats of the movement, again, this is an article from socialistalternative.org, Brian Koulouris, during the next 100 days, build resistance to the Trump agenda, published on January 26th, still up on the website, of course. Quote, we need to base our movement on the needs of working people and not limit our demands to what the Democratic Party leadership will accept. We can build the biggest possible protest by calling for popular measures like defending and extending reproductive rights, ending deportations of immigrants, and establishing improved Medicare for all. We need to keep fighting for a $15 minimum wage, tuition-free college, and an end to mass incarceration. We need unity and solidarity of all people actively opposing Trump. Well, anyway, I meant that one paragraph to really get into that first. Socialist Alternative thinks that we need a new party with 99% to be an uncompromising force in fighting Trump's agenda. The Democratic Party leadership helped pave the way for Trump's victory, and their politicians are overwhelmingly controlled by the corporate elites. Mainstream Democrats didn't stop Bush's agenda, and they haven't delivered on their promises to combat racism and sexism or improve the lives of working people. This is why some working people were seduced by Trump's pro-worker demagogy, something that which will be undermined by experience. Socialist Alternative will work alongside progressive Democrats around clear demands to mobilize people into action, but we will not limit our program, strategy, or tactics to what is acceptable to the Democratic Party or, as he says, to the corporate Democrats. Instead, we will base ourselves on the needs of working people to resist a system and a presidency that's bent on destruction. So there's a lot of stuff coming up to fight Trump on, and I think there's going to be, if what's happened so far, stuff coming so quickly that there will be protests from sections of society and different types of groups that won't necessarily link up to a broader movement. That's unfortunate, but it's also somewhat understandable that the attacks are coming so rapidly, and that's part of Trump's strategy, the Trump administration's strategy, Republican strategy, et cetera, to sort of shock and awe type assault on everything that they want, that they think they can get away with, very, very quickly to stop a resistance from building. And I would argue that even if they're successful in sort of disorientating or preventing or atomizing a resistance to assert at the beginning, that one will eventually coalesce. I mean, Socialist Alternative will play its part in coalescing the different anti-Trump forces together where we can. But I think in a broader sense, and you saw this in the women's movement, I think that will come back again. You will see more, despite the repression, despite, like, there are, for example, there are cities and states that are passing laws now against protesters that are really, you remember you've been reading in the corporate media or hearing that 1984, the book is like exploding in popularity again. That is for good reasons. And one of them, which some of the buyers, of course, are unaware of, but whatever, is buyers of 1984, is that there are states out there and there are cities out there that are passing laws now to basically criminalize any sort of protest, to make it so expensive or so dangerous that they hope it will scare people, right? And I would argue that initially that might work, but over time, and I mean time not too far away, within the first 4 years, and hopefully only 4 years or less, that there will be resistance. We'll get together more than it will not get together. There'll be more unity around the left and so on in terms of fighting Trump than, and I don't mean left, I mean left in a broad sense, very broad sense. Also, by the way, that just reminded me of something, and we've raised this at other shows, but let's keep this in mind. The idea of getting so demoralized about Trump that you're just speaking in emotional terms, which of course is understandable, but doesn't really help totally. You have to get involved and fight publicly, fight on the streets, organize politically, learn, discuss, all that good stuff. Well, guess what? Trump is not invincible. There's going to be a certain attempt to make him seem invincible. It's already started. Again, the normalization of Trump, the Democrats coming in, this appeal Trump is always making to the military and the police, that's not accidental. That's to present some sort of idea that Trump is unassailable, because at the bottom line, it's just plain brute force to keep him in power. Well, there's real problems with that argument, thankfully. And they're shown historically, right? Nixon forced out of power. There are times in U.S. history where these jokers are forced into, resigning or forced out of office through impeachment. And that is, you know, with the way Trump is out there, again, he's not out there as much of a loose cannon as some people think, but he is somewhat of a loose cannon, I would argue, for sections of the Republicans and the big business and the corporate elite. They would have preferred Clinton, a lot of them, of course. Although now they kind of like what's happening with Trump. Trump will make mistakes. That class will make mistakes. They always do. And with Trump being so disliked, and again, this gets into why there were sections of big business, big sections, the majority really, that supported Hillary, that he'll be very vulnerable, and businesses and then the corporations will say, look, this guy is pissing off, I'm putting it simply, but it's the gist of it, this guy's pissing off people to the point where they're becoming anti-capitalist, anti-system. Or what you hear a lot is the political system, they're losing faith in the system. You hear that already from the corporate media. Now, the corporate media turns around the next breath and tries to pump up the system. The Democratic Party leaders do the same thing, try to pump up the system. And this is where, of course, as socialists, we part ways completely with them. We're not trying to pump up the system. The system is showing itself to be what it is. It is what it is. You know, this is not an anomaly. Trump is not an anomaly. There are many other examples. Andrew Jackson, Nixon, Reagan. There's a lot of them. And even the ones that aren't Trump, they're going to accomplish. I mean, Roosevelt, the big liberal icon, interned Japanese Americans, right? JFK, the big liberal icon, invaded Cuba with the Bay of Pigs, you know, and still kept an embargo around Cuba. And if you go back and actually, you know, it's great to be able to get recordings and television programs, you know, video and audio recordings of these old presidents, because the way they're written about in the corporate media, it's completely different from what they were really like. Kennedy, if you look at Kennedy in a mainstream media broadcast from the time he was in power, all he was doing was inveighing against communism and communists, quote unquote. That he was obsessed with that because the system was obsessed with that at the time, because Stalinism, which we don't support, but it was powerful at the time, relatively speaking, and a challenge, in a way, an indirect challenge to capitalism, or they thought it was, the capitalists thought it was, and they couldn't stand it. So you go back to John F. Kennedy, you're going to wonder why communism is coming out of his mouth when you were taught he was this brave, wonderful politician. Or let's go to, again, Carter, who we already mentioned, and then actually watch Carter make a speech to the American public to accept lower living standards, watch him deregulate industry and union bust like crazy, along with Ted Kennedy and so on. So the mythology is out there. You don't have to buy into it. You don't have to accept the system as is. You don't have to genuflect before, you know, authority figures picked by the capitalist class. Like people have said, oh, we get rid of Trump, you got Pence or Spence or whatever his name is, right, as the backup. I'm sorry, I don't remember his exact name, which is, I think it's, isn't it Pence? I think it's Pence. Anyway, yeah, that is horrible. You're right. But who says that's the only choices? You know, it's like, who created that paradigm for you that you need like this uber leader, this imperial president in power to function? We don't need that as society. We don't need that as individuals. It'd be much better to have a group of people elected, a small group of people elected, subject to recall and a lot of other things, making the average wage of the people they represent. By the way, I forgot to mention, when Shama Sawant, as a socialist city councilor, she makes the consciously everyone from Socialist Alternative or the Committee for Works International that runs for office, they run at the average wage of the working people they're representing. They only take that salary. They don't take a higher salary than that. And that just drives big business crazy. They don't talk about that much, but Shama's only pulling in like $40,000 something a year, whereas the Seattle City Councilors make $120,000 or more per year. And the rest Shama donates to progressive causes Ginger Jensen will do the same in Minneapolis if she is elected. By the way, remember I mentioned Warren and Sanders and their role in normalizing Trump and the Democrats' role. Here's an interesting example from something called Boston. Something called Boston Magazine. Actually, that's pretty well known here in Boston. Boston Magazine, a news blog by Kyle Scott Klaus. I'm surprised they published this. Senators Warren and Markey. Markey is another liberal Democratic senator here. Senators Warren and Markey here in Massachusetts vote to confirm three more Trump cabinet picks. Then there's a little subhead, so much for the resistance. And again, I'm reading this so you don't get illusions of the Democratic Party leading the resistance. There is a resistance, but it's not going to be fundamentally led, at least not if it's successful or in a good way, by the Democratic Party, although they're trying to take advantage of it, obviously. So, quote, just 3 days after Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey addressed a historic crowd gathered on the Common for the Boston Women's March, vowing to fight back against President Donald Trump's agenda, the Democratic senators voted to confirm three of Trump's cabinet picks, including Ben Carson. So he quotes Warren speaking at the rally, and then as a member of the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, Warren voted to confirm Carson, a famed neurosurgeon and one-time Republican presidential candidate, as head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Keep in mind, this is after Carson said, quote, it will not be my intention to do anything to benefit any American, end quote, in exchange with Warren. Well, now that's a goal that I'm sure he has already achieved. In fact, I'd say he's actually hurt Americans a lot. Warren's office issued a statement Tuesday afternoon explaining her vote to confirm Carson, et cetera. But Carson, by the way, who previously compared public housing to communism, and it is sort of like communism. I can tell this is a liberal writing this, but, you know, whatever. And said that there are, of course, differences in the way it's public housing is implemented compared to communism, and said that LGBTQ Americans do not deserve, quote, extra rights, unquote. Jeez. Okay. Then Warren votes for him. Warren says something about holding him to what he talked about during his thing, supporting him, voting for him. Yeah. Markey voted to confirm two Trump cabinet picks Tuesday, billionaire investor Wilbur Ross for Commerce Secretary and Elaine Chao, former Labor Secretary and wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, as Transportation Secretary. Oh, man. You know, back in the Depression, a sociologist named Frederick Lunenburg wrote a book called 60 Families or something like that, where he showed how 60 families controlled a huge amount of wealth in U.S. society, vast majority of wealth in U.S. society. This is looking pretty incestuous, man, when you get Elaine Chao back in there. Anyway, it's even worse than you think. Markey. The author... transposes Markey's votes to the speech that Markey made at the women's thing, at the women's march, where he invoked revolution, which makes me kind of gag a little bit. Anyway, here's your headline. Running out of time here, so I'm going to do some headlines here. Trump appoints hate group leader to Border Patrol agency. The reason I mentioned this is I had not heard much about this, and it's from January 27th. From not sure what publication. Didn't print out for me. Julie Kirshner, former executive director of an anti-immigrant hate group, now has a key role with the U.S. Border Patrol. So, of course, this goes along with the wall and all that. Southern Poverty Law Center labels her group a hate group, crediting its white nationalist and pro-eugenics founder, John Tanton, with creating the modern anti-immigration movement in the U.S. by advocating a complete moratorium on all immigration, encouraging violence towards racialized migrants. Kirshner worked with Tanton, et cetera. So try to find that. I know I think it's from the Southern Poverty Law Center that I picked this up, and they are quoted in the article as well. Sorry, I'm coughing a little bit. Last but not least, in our less than a minute, go to seattle.gov, check out Shama Sawant, District 3. Trump attacks sanctuary city. Seattle should fight back. Mass protests on May 1st. So we're already looking, May 1st, International Workers' Day, to be a historic day for immigrant rights protests, et cetera. And Shama invokes the 2006 protest. So yeah, International Women's Day, March 8th, which by the way was started by socialists, and International Workers' Day, May 1st, of course, started by socialists, 2 days in which to protest build huge protests, huge movements against the Trump administration. So we're out of time. Thanks for listening to Social Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we'll be back a week, 2 weeks from today, more on how to fight Trump and what's going on in the fight against Trump. But also look beyond that. Look at the system. Look at capitalism. And we can do better. We can have a world where people have what they need and decide what they need and want, and how to be reduced democratic.